Conversation with Uisce Fogarty on Radio Kerry.
Hello there, and you're very welcome to the programme. We shall forward it with you for the next hour. If you would like to get in contact with us tonight, you can text David on 083 300 3300 or call Kenya on 066 71 23666. A few weeks ago, I had the pleasure of travelling up to the Dáil in Dublin to interview a member of the Senedd, Senator David Norris. We had a fascinating discussion about his life and times and his intentions to run for the presidency. And now I invite you to sit back, turn up the radio and enjoy this interview with Senator David Norris. Senator David Norris, first of all, you're very welcome to the programme and you're very welcome to Radio Kerry.
Well, thank you very much, Uisce. It's always a pleasure to be in Kerry, whether it's just on the radio as it is now or physically down in that beautiful county. I always enjoy it, and particularly the independence of mind of the people of Kerry and their wonderful way of handling language, the way they savour and appreciate it. And of course, we have several Kerry people in the Senedd. I sit next to Joe O'Toole, for example, from Dingle. Terrific, and a wonderful, fluent Irish speaker.
Yeah, and of course, Paul Coughlin, Mark Daly.
They're also very good friends of mine. Paul is a marvellous man, and he always manages to get something in about Killarney. No matter what is happening on the order of business, Paul will be there with the message about Killarney, the beauty of the lakes. And
the Killarney House, which he's trying to get now.
Muckross
House and yes. Killarney House, which he's trying to get refurbished. So if he brings that up again, Senator, Killarney House to get refurbished.
Well, he always gets support from me. He definitely does. And we were good old allies. And he had me down there quite recently to speak at a dinner in the Killarney Golf Club. And we had a wonderful time. They gave me a nice jumper to take away with me.
Tell me this before we
start
off. And of
course, Mark, because we have to keep ourselves in with all the parties. See, and as I was saying to you earlier, I maintain friendships with people from all the different parties, although I retain independence. And Mark Daly is a real addition to the work of the House. And I think it's marvellous that we get highly articulate, intelligent young people like Mark, and of course Dominic Hannigan in the Labour Party, who's wonderful as well. And we have Ivana Bacik. A lot of young people. Are younger people who are getting involved now. Thank God, because I think it's so easy for people to be disillusioned and cynical about politics after all that's gone on. So it's great to have young people.
You're very much associated with James Joyce, of course. You're a Joycean scholar. And James Joyce and Gaelic football and you and Tony Hanahaw going to see the Dubs playing. I never thought that you were a bit of a Gaelic, a GMN.
Well, up to a point. And I have to say this, I think the new Croke Park is absolutely fantastic. It's a superb facility. But when I was in Trinity in the early 60s, I got Foundation Scholarship. It gave me a free set of rooms. My great pal was doing medicine. He had a friend who'd contracted for a double set of rooms. The other fellow let him down. And I was asked, would I go in with this fellow? And I said, well, if he's any kind of human being at all, of course I will have no problem to save him the money. I went in. His name was Gabriel Slowey. He was captain of the GAA. I got to know all about the GAA, the Sigerson Cup and all this kind of stuff. And because of Tony, there was a series in the 1970s. I don't know if you would be old enough to remember this, Uisce, but in the 1970s, mid-70s, there was a terrific battle between a series of battles, actually between Dublin and Kerry. They were the really titanic struggles, and Tony was captain of the Dublin football team. He got me a seat on the Cusack stand for each one.
You were born in Leopoldville, Senator, and in the Belgian Congo.
That's right, exactly. It was called Leopoldville then. It's now called Kinshasa. And I was there because my father was an Englishman, like Padraig Pearse. I always put that in. People then say, are you really Irish? And of course, my father died when I was six. I only saw him three times because he was in Central Africa. He was chief engineer for Lever Brothers. And he was designing machines for extracting oil from palm nuts and so on and so forth. So I had very little contact with him, and then he died when I was very young. So I was brought up by my Irish relations, and people were always talking about the way I speak. I'm completely unaware of it, but people are always talking about it. And some people seem to like it. My aunt hated it. She said I had a voice like a rusty key turning in a lock. But when she got to 95, she revised her view and she said, well, I still don't like the tone of your voice, but at least I can understand what you say. You articulate. Other people seem to mumble. I think she was actually going deaf. But I remember there was a debate on the Gay Byrne radio show on one occasion about what my accent was, and the general consensus was, it was very amusing, they said, it's probably a Protestant accent. I didn't know there was a sectarian accent, but apparently that's what they thought mine was.
You were first elected to the Senate in 1987.
That's right.
Back that far. Why did you go for the Senate first year?
Well, partly because I was friendly with Mary Robinson. Mary and I entered college on the same day. We both got foundation scholarship the same day, graduated the same day. And she was my barrister in a series of cases I took. And she decided to run for the Senate. And in her first campaign, I was part of her campaign team. And I learned from that how it could be done. And the other thing was, even if you weren't successful, and it took me 10 years and six elections, including that awful period when there were three elections in 18 months in the early 80s, and a by-election, it took me all that time to get in. But I realized that even if you were not successful, you had the opportunity to distribute seditious literature at the expense of the taxpayer. So I could plant all my revolutionary ideas in the minds of the graduates, some of whom were significant opinion makers and people of substance. And I could sort of plant these ideas in their minds and get these subjects discussed. So that was what started me off. And of course, like all naive young people, I thought I was good. I thought I was so brilliant that I would be elected on the first count. And not only that, I would top the poll. Well, it came as a bit of a surprise when I found I got 230 votes.
Looking back now at that first sitting of the Senate when you were involved, Senator, what names do come to mind that are gone now, that were there then? Just to remember people that are gone.
Well, some are gone to the reward, like Liam Nocton, who is Cathaoirleach of the Shannon, and a thoroughly, thoroughly decent man. And in a way, what happened to him is indicative of the pressures people are under. He was Cathaoirleach of the Shannon. He also nurtured his local constituency in Roscommon, and he had a state car and a driver, and he was making his way from one funeral to another when the car was hit at speed by somebody from Eastern Europe driving on the wrong side of the road, and he was killed instantly. And I think it is, I did a lot of driving just last weekend. I had to go down to Laois, and then across to Kilkenny, then up to Dublin, then across to Carrick-on-Shannon to be MC at the Water Music Festival. And I just thought of my colleagues, people who come from Kerry, for example, often Donegal, and the amount of strain there must be on them driving up and down all the time from the farthest parts of the island to Dublin. You know, I don't think people realise the pressure under which people in political life have to operate.
You have been a member of the Senate ever since then. Would you have preferred to have done anything else in your life, only what you're doing now?
No, I very much enjoy what I'm doing now, and I'm a little bit like Edith Piaf, you know, the wonderful French singer. No, I have no regrets.
Are you a singer? Would you stand up and sing at a function?
Well, not really. I mean, as you can tell from what I've just done, I wouldn't be particularly good at it. But I used to sing in the church choir in St. Bartholomew's Church in Clyde Road, which is a nice old-fashioned high church kind of place with incense and candles and all these kind of rather naughty things, which were delightful. But I do sing in my one-man show about James Joyce. I perform the end of a story called Clay, and I have to sing in falsetto as an old lady. I can do it for you in part two, if you like.
Yes, we can. We'll do that in part two. We'd love to do that.
And I've just done it for a meeting of graduates here in the lunchroom in Leinster House.
What did your day comprise of today now, as a matter of interest? It's 4 o'clock in the evening now. We're here in Leinster House.
Yes. Well, I was up early, did my laundry. Then I collected shoes from a nice little man who repairs shoes for me down behind the Pro Cathedral. Then I had a series of appointments. I had to record a couple of radio interviews. I had an official lunch with members of my constituency, and I've just left an important meeting planning strategy for the future for my political career. So it was a relaxed and easy day comparatively, because the Senate ended yesterday.
Now, after I leave you, Senator, and I head back down to the kingdom, what does the rest of your day comprise of? Are you an early man going to bed?
No, I'm not. I'm late going to bed. And one of the things will be, for example, I will once again clear my desk completely. I try to do that every day because of the enormous volume of emails I get. I mean, I would work a 14 to 16 hour day. This is what always makes me laugh when I hear people on the radio saying, oh, should they get paid for doing nothing? I'd like to see them doing the volume of work that people like myself do. I mean, if you're an independent, you have to cover everything from foreign affairs to the economy to human rights to transport to the arts. All these kind of things have to be covered. You don't have spokespeople. You are the spokesperson on everything. I have a huge volume of correspondence.
Do you travel outside Dublin often? Are you traveling to all corners of the country?
Up and down to Cork, as I said. I was down at the dinner last year, just a few months ago, in Killarney. I've spoken at the Writers' Week in Listowel on occasion. I've been up and down to Cork, I think, about five times in the last month, including one where you were asking what kind of day I have. I left here after the end of business in the Senate. I flew down to Cork. I was met at the airport, driven over to Clonakilty. Then spent about 4 hours in a school, a girls' school, visiting their transition year, seeing their projects. Absolutely fascinating, fantastic, and it will give you a real heart for the future. Then driven back to Cork, into bed at 1:15, up at 6 o'clock to get the plane back to Dublin to be in time for the order of business.
You're a remarkable man. We're going for a short break. I'm talking to Senator David Norris. When we come back, we have lots and lots more to talk about, and we'll be talking about he throwing his cap into the presidential campaign.
In conversation with Wishy Fogarty on Radio Kerry. In conversation with Wishy Fogarty on Radio Kerry.
You're very welcome back to the second part of the programme. I'm talking to Senator David Norris here in Leinster House. We're talking about his life and times. Is it true that you were the first gay politician in the world?
Well, I wouldn't say that, no. But what happened was I was elected. And one of the reasons I was, it took a long time for me to get elected, was that I was always openly gay as a candidate. And I was the first person in the world elected to a national parliament as an openly gay candidate. There were obviously people who were gay before who were involved in politics one way or another, but they concealed the fact. And now, of course, there are quite a few. There's Peter Mandelson in Britain. There's, I think, the German foreign minister or environment minister something recently, and the prime minister of Iceland and so on. So it's not so unusual now. But, of course, it's not exactly an advantage, but it's no longer the disadvantage of the world. People are used to it.
Did you find, David, coming up through life and even today, did you find discrimination against your views?
Well, up to a point, there was a hesitation. I think it was natural because it was regarded as a very contentious issue in the old days. And it was something that was unpleasant. People didn't want to talk about it. I mean, people are a bit shy about talking about sex anyway. There's a natural reticence. But it was so unjust, the fact that people could be sent to jail. And their lives destroyed and ruined, and they're humiliated and lose their families. And it was an unnecessary waste of human resources to treat people like that, I felt. And of course, there was a certain amount of discrimination, some of it unconscious. But I'm very proud of the fact that my colleagues in the Oireachtas absolutely refused to accept discrimination, because there was an attempt by a tiny minority, a tiny rump of people in the Senate who wanted to introduce amendments. And those amendments would have been extremely offensive. They would have introduced literally apartheid.
And on his letters last week, there was a wonderful debate in the Senate about the Civil Partnership Bill.
Exactly.
Evidently, from what I could read, that it was one of the best debates that had taken part in the Senate, even though people are saying we'll get rid of the Senate, but we'll talk about it later.
Yes.
Is that right? There was a great debate.
It was wonderful. It was very remarkable. But that's where they were trying to introduce these amendments. And they would, for example, have allowed people to refuse to sell a newspaper or sweets or a wedding cake or confectionery or give a hairdo or something like that to people people on the basis that they were gay. And this is supposed to be for some kind of conscience clause. I mean, it's absolute blatant discrimination and quite disgusting. And one of the worst, and Senator Walsh claimed that this wording was provided to him by what he described as a Christian church. Church they might have been, Christian they weren't, because we'd like to tell you what it is, Wishy. It was that they could withdraw counselling services if the effect of such counselling was to, and I quote him directly here, to facilitate the continuance, the perpetuation, or to facilitate the perpetuation of the relationship. Yeah. In other words, that means what they were doing was, if two human beings who loved each other, if their relationship got into trouble, the Christian church's idea was to stand back, rub your hands and gloat and say, oh great, they're going to split up. That doesn't sound Christian to me. It doesn't sound as if they've ever heard the parable of the Good Samaritan told by Christ himself about the man who crossed the road to help somebody from a completely different ethos.
But the whole thing is changing, David, isn't it? With what's happening in the church and everything, yes. What has happened, everything is changing, all views are changing. By the way, I just mentioned today, there was a lot of talk, a lot of people saying about get rid of the Synod, abolish it completely. You were, of course, totally against it.
Well, I was very much in favour of reforming it, because I think it should be made much more democratic. At the moment, the only democratic element is the university senators. And the reason for that is because the nominating body is graduates, and they're also the group that are allowed to vote. On the other seats, 11 of them were nominated directly without even an election, even a farce of an election. And the last election was a farce on that panel, because it was a by-election in which the entire electoral register was 227 people. I mean, that's not democratic. In Trinity, I have nearly 60,000 voters voting for me because the ordinary people are given the vote. Joe O'Toole has about 120,000. Those are real constituencies. And what I think they should do is they should look at the nominating bodies, tighten them up, make sure that every profession, every workplace is represented there, like the fishermen, the architects, the farmers, the doctors, they should all, nurses, they should all be represented, but they should not have just the power of nomination, which is what they have at the moment, and then the political parties take over and stick in their own people. I think they should have the power to vote as well, but each citizen should only be allowed one vote, so they'd have to select a panel. Supposing, for example, you had several different qualifications, you'd have to...
You're a university lecturer by profession, is that right, David?
I was. I retired quite some years ago, and I'm now, since 1994, I've been a full-time senator. Before that, I taught in Trinity, and what happened was I did particularly well in my final exam. I got a double first, and one of the papers they seemed to like particularly was on American literature, and they'd nobody to teach American literature. And I loved the jazz age. People think like Gatsby, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and I loved the music as well, so I knew about the culture. And so I was invited to give a series of lectures that took me up to Christmas. And after that, I went on the staff permanently. So I was an undergraduate one day, a graduate the next, and on the staff the day after. It was wonderful. And I did that for nearly 30 years, because I started when I was so young.
If you were to stand over there at that door now outside where we're sitting, yes, and look over here and look at David Norris, how would you describe him to me?
I say he'd be rather talkative, noisy, balding, fat little man.
Go on, talk away, yes?
Well, I think he would be somebody who had a good sense of humour, and that I really do enjoy a laugh, and who dresses either in outrageously clashing colours or in very conservative suits. So when I'm working, I'm, as you see me now, with a Trinity tie and a grey pinstripe suit, but left to my own devices, I'd sport a kind of Hawaiian shirt and sandals and short trousers.
I was expecting to see your trademark Dickie Bob today, but I'm a bit disappointed you haven't it on.
Well, you see, today I have the Trinity tie,
yeah,
because I was talking to Trinity people. And I told them the story about how I was in Budapest and I was raising the question of Raoul Wallenberg, the wonderful Swedish diplomat who, armed only with his moral authority, went into the trains taking the Jewish people to Auschwitz and rescued tens of thousands of them. And I went there to speak, but some of the politicos tried to interfere. And I went up to the platform fellow and I said, look, I had an agreement, but it was broken. But I'm determined to speak about Wallenberg. And I have a powerful... Do you know what he said? He said, Is that a Trinity tie? I said, yes, it is. Oh, he said, how's RBD French? He was Trinity himself, recognised the tie, and thanks to him I got to speak at the main convention of the entire meeting. Wasn't that good?
It's a pity that Radio Kerry haven't got ties, because you could have taken that off, put on your Radio Kerry tie and spoken to me with it. That's a little thing I must bring back to Radio Kerry, David. They should start producing ties. Come here.
I mean, they should. You're involved
in so much. Could you rattle off very quickly for me and the whole number of... Everything, the institutions and committees, and you do an awful lot of work for World Poor and everything like that.
Well, I'm involved in a large number of things. I mean, I'm on the board of the Voluntary Service Overseas. I'm involved very much with the blind. I have a slight eye problem myself, and I'm involved with blind. I'm involved in the Dublin Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. I'm very much committed to Carmichael House, you know, which houses 70 voluntary organisations. This terrific umbrella group for them all. And then, of course, North Great George Street. I was the founder of the Preservation Society there and its first chairman. I was chair for 25 years. And then I was very actively involved in the Friends of the Library in Trinity, helping to raise funds to keep the library going and investing in rare books and all this kind of stuff. I'm in the Georgian Society, I'm in the RDS. I was one of the founders with Michael D. Higgins of the Foreign Affairs Committee, so I'm very interested in foreign affairs. I used to be a member of a gym until it closed down. Yeah. And I was the organizer of our little team of politicians in Operation Transformation.
That's right, on the telly, I saw that.
And we won.
And you're looking slim, trim, and brimful of energy.
Well, I'm better than I was. I lost a stone and a half. I have to keep it up now. That's the thing. Yeah. Because one of the problems with political life is it's so chaotic. It's very difficult. You don't have a routine. You can't run to a timetable like that. You can never really predict what's going to happen, and particularly where the Senate is run at the moment. You don't know whether you're going to meet or whether you're not going to meet. So it makes life difficult to organise, and that makes it more difficult to slot in a regular pattern of exercise. But, of course, I walk from North Great George Street down here to Leinster House every day, to and fro, and that at least is a bit of exercise. And my house is a lovely old 18th century house built in 1787. First occupant, a man called Ralph Norris. Isn't that interesting? I've no idea who he was.
I saw the inside of your house, yeah. Living with Lucy, is that right?
Yes, and wasn't she fun? She's a bit of a divil, but she was
fabulous. House. How old is your house, by the way?
1787, 250 years or thereabouts. And with regard to the exercise, you see, walking up and down, I go up 10 half flights of stairs every night to bed. And one of my neighbours recently had a perforated duodenal ulcer, which could have killed him. And the doctor said, the reason you're alive today is walking up and down those stairs in the Georgian house of yours, because it kept his heart pumping.
Great story. Listen, David, we're going for another break. If you want to get onto the programme, 0667123666 or 0833003300, even though the programme is pre-recorded, we'll take your comments and we'll read them out next week. We're going for a short break. Stay with us, because when I come back, I'm going to be talking to David Norris about his cap into the ring for the Presidents of Ireland. Stay with us.
In conversation with Uaisle Fogarty on Radio Kerry. In conversation with Uaisle Fogarty on Radio Kerry.
You're very welcome back to the programme. I'm talking to Senator David Norris. David, you're after throwing your cap into the ring for the Presidency of Ireland. Is that correct? Tell me when and why and how.
Well, in a manner of speaking, Uaisle, what happened was about 3 months ago now, it was coming up to a weekend, and I was phoned by one of the Sunday newspapers, and they said, is it true that you're interested in going for the park? And I said, well, what put that in your head? And they said, well, there is the Facebook site with 850 people on it. So I said to them, well, 850 people won't get me to the park, but it's very flattering that that number should spontaneously have decided to get together and to see if I can go for the presidency. So I said, of course I will. I'm the kind of person, if an opportunity comes, if a ball comes flying in my direction, I don't stand there with my gob open saying, oh, I wonder what to do. I will give it a bloody good wind, either with my foot or with a bat or a hurl or whatever it is, to see if I can score a goal. You don't waste your opportunities. So that weekend there was a piece saying, well, very nice fellow, you know, does quite a lot of good work in the Senate, but a bit detached from reality. He thinks he has a snowball's chance of getting into the park. He's 50-1, rank outsider, number 14, 850 people on the website. It's now 26,000 people. I'm the favourite with the bookies, which doesn't say anything very much, except that a few people put a couple of quid on. Including myself. I put 50 quid on the week after this article appeared, and I thought, oh, God, it'd be great, I'd get 50-1. I didn't. I was already down to 20-1, and it's now 5-2. So the first hurdle will be to get a nomination.
Yeah.
And that's not easy. You can do it with 20 Oireachtas members. But the parties have nibbled, but the condition would be several parties that I should join the party. I won't do that. I've always been an independent, and I've given a commitment to that, and I'm not going to break it. There's enough cynicism in Irish politics without me joining the ranks of people about whom it is said, oh, we had great principles until they waved a job under his nose. Mm. That's not going to be me. Then four county councils, Dana and Derek Nally both did that, but it's extremely difficult. And the last time Dana tried again, but she missed it by a couple of hours. It's extremely tight timing. But I have a very good team, and I believe that I'll be able to do it. I hope so. And then there's the question of the whole race itself and winning that. Now, in this, of course, the media is very important. That's one reason I'm really happy to be on Radio Kerry. I always would be happy to be on it anyway, but it gives me an opportunity of explaining to people. And I will be down in Kerry, because if I get a nomination, or even in the run-up to the nomination, I'll be going around all over the country, because I think it's important to meet people and to listen to what they've got to say. I'm a bit of a talker, as you've discovered, Rishi, but on this occasion, I'll be happy to listen to people. Now, there was a third way, and it was recommended by the Oireachtas Committee. The report produced a report into the presidency, and they recommended that 10,000 citizens should have the right, if they banded together, to put somebody into the competition. But the parties all agreed to it, but they never legislated for it. So it only exists as a kind of moral template. But I think it's very important to say I have 26,000, 2.5 times what they said should get a nomination.
So what's the bottom line, David, in relation to being nominated?
Well, the bottom line is I believe I'll probably have to go to the county councils, and I've no problem with that, because I respect the work of local authorities, and I think it's possible, at least, and particularly in places like Kerry, where they are independent-minded, the people might say, well, we should give this fellow a chance. Even if we don't agree with what he says, let's see what the Irish people have to say about it. That the race should be that little bit more open. It shouldn't be closed to everybody except the political parties.
Why do you think that you'd make a good president of Ireland?
Well, I mean, that's the kind of thing which can lead you to be very pompous if you answer that in the question the wrong way. It doesn't mean that I think I'm better than anybody else, but I do have certain skills. Now, I was put forward as Lord Mayor of Dublin. I said absolutely no, because I don't have the right kind of skills. But I'm an ideas man. And I think that what people want in the presidency is somebody who is reasonably fluent, who, as people have very kindly said to me, who won't let the nation down. They won't be embarrassed or ashamed. I can hold my own in terms of impromptu speeches, conversations, meeting with people, precisely because I feel equal with anybody, whether they're a bishop, a mullah, a pope, a president, a queen, a king, an emperor. They're just human beings like I am. I don't think I'm better than anybody else, but neither do I think there's anybody else better than me.
No, I tell you the truth, David, I'd love to see you marching into Croke Park on Isle Island final day when Kerry be playing the Dubs and you'll be president of Ireland and you sitting up there watching.
And I couldn't take sides. I'd have to be above it all. But I can tell you this, they could train the camera on me and I can sing every single line of Auron Navian Os Gaelic Ashina Fina Foil of Horfig Gallagher and Bwindar Sluhar Tlingdron Coing, and I can go on right at the very end.
Yeah. If you did become President of Ireland, is there anything, one thing in particular, two things that you would like to achieve?
Well, I think my election would make a statement that we accept now as a people that we are a diverse people and that we are a sophisticated, young, modern state with its eye on the future and its eye on the welfare of all of its people. And I'd like to think that I would broaden it out a bit. And I would be as accessible to the people as possible. I mean, it's anticipating things, of course, even to imagine, to presume that I could get into the park. But I would be very happy, for example, to be allowed to spend the occasional weekend in my own home in the community that I've come to know and love in central Dublin, in North Great George Street. There might be security problems that I don't know. And the other thing I would very much like is to continue going to St. Patrick's Cathedral, where I go every Sunday. And I said that, somebody said it to me in the cathedral the other day, and they said, oh, well, when you come on Sundays, you'll be sitting up there pointing to the president's pew. And I said, no, I won't, unless I'm representing the nation at a state function. Otherwise, I'm just an ordinary member of the congregation, and I wouldn't want to be sitting up there. I'd like to sit where I always have sat and be part of the congregation and go and have coffee afterwards. Now, whether that's feasible, I just don't know, because any head of state, I suppose, stands in danger of being mobbed by tourists and this sort of business. But I don't think it'd be very extravagant to man to...
Have you any idea, David, who's going to be running against you? There's talks, actually, about a Kelly man, Sean Kelly. There's talks about Sean Kelly being nominated. Rachel, I don't know whether there's anything that or not, but have you any idea who might be going against you?
Well, I haven't really, to be quite honest with you, because it'd be rather presumptuous for me to throw their hat in the ring. I haven't even managed to get my own in. But names have been suggested in the betting list, for example, and they're all very talented, decent, good people. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to... I won't be opposing them. I'll be promoting myself. And I think I have certain things I could offer. And if I confronted one issue straight on, the gay issue, that's what is in the back of everybody's mind, because I was the first person elected to the National Parliament. I'd be the first head of state in the world. Now, that's interesting, because anybody else who's elected, non-event. The international media, not interested. So what? X, Y, Z, XTD, former MEP, whatever it is, former senator, elected. If I was elected, every organ of news and comment would be interested in that. If I went to North America, every single news channel would switch on for. They'd be there. Now, I've shown I can do this kind of job before. I represented Ireland in a massive TV, radio, and journalist blitz right across the United States of America. Very successful in the late 80s. I did in the 90s. I was a roving ambassador in Eastern Europe and Scandinavia on behalf of the government, opening up cultural exchanges and this kind of thing. So I've shown I can do it. And I am a cute enough old politico to know, given that opportunity, they would turn up, they would ask about the gay issue. I can deal with it, park it, and get on to selling Ireland to the world. And you couldn't buy that access. It's worth billions.
What was, or who was, the greatest influence in your life?
Well, there would be a number. I mean, I think probably in my family, the women, my grandmother, who I loved, my mother, who was a very gentle but brilliantly witty woman, and my aunt, who was a very remarkable woman, brought up as a young lady and then had to go out and work when she was in her 50s and look after her parents because, of course, they were affected by the economic war and the crash in land prices and all this kind of stuff. And curious to the end of her days. I mean, she was had an active curiosity in absolutely everything, even when she was over 100. I think that keeps you going. And then politically, of course, my great friend, the late Dr. Noel Brown, who was popular, I think, all over Ireland because of the wonderful campaign he fought with others in his department, but he was the principal leader of it, against TB. He eradicated TB in this country. And then his wonderful visionary mother and child scheme, where he would assist mothers and children in the early days of their parenting and give them grants for milk and all this kind of stuff. He's a terrific, marvellous man. Then if I look around, I think of people like, I find the Dalai Lama a real inspiration because of his absolute adherence to the peaceful path. And I've met him on a number of occasions, and on one of the recent occasions, we were discussing the Panchen level and the appalling way in which the Chinese have interfered, an atheistic regime interfering with religious beliefs of the Tibetans, quite disgraceful. And he said to me that he was praying for the souls of the Chinese because of the damage they were doing to themselves by their cruelty to the Tibetans. Now, that is wonderful, isn't it? If you look at your own people being hammered and then you pray for the oppressors because of the damage they're doing to their own spirits. I think that's wonderful.
Come here, we're going for another break. 0667123666, 0833300300. Even though this is a pre-recorded programme, get into Tanya with your comments. By the way, David is on sound tonight, doing a great job as usual. We'll be back shortly. More talk from Senator David Norris. Stay with us.
In conversation with Rishi Fogarty on Radio Kerry. In conversation with Rishi Fogarty on Radio Kerry.
You're very welcome back to the final part of the programme. I'm talking to Senator David Norris. David, you're a very, very outgoing person, very much so. Do you ever get depressed, or what depresses you, or what brings you down? Or would there be days that you just didn't want to be involved with people? And
No, I don't suffer from depression. And I remember one occasion, my doctor, who's an old family friend as well, I think he was half joking, he said, "Well, you know, I sometimes wonder about bipolar." And I said, "What's bipolar?" And he explained, I said, "That sounds like manic depression to me." We said, "Yes," he said, "but there are pills, you know, and things you can do." I said, "Listen to me, let me tell you. If I have manic depression or bipolar, you better get a safety helmet on fairly quick, because in my 65 years, I was 65 when he said it to me, I seem to be always manic. I haven't been depressed at all. So if I do go into depression, I'll go right through the planet and out the other side with the depth of the depression, because I'm naturally an energetic person and I'm a positive person. I'm on the side of life and I see its beauty, partly because I know how short-lived that beauty is. I mean, ever since I found my mother dead in her bed on Christmas 40 years ago, I've realized that life is a very fragile thing, and so you have to savor every moment. I mean, it is such a wonderful privilege to be alive. Of course I'm not depressed. I mean, I got a bit upset during the last couple of recessions when I used to get nasty letters from the bank. I was afraid to open the post in the morning, but I got over it. I survived it. I paid off my bills. I paid off my mortgages. I'm okay. I'm very lucky. The people in my time of life should be in that position if they can possibly make it. In the old days, when I drank too much, I would possibly get a hangover, and that can be rather miserable.
Do you drink now?
Well, moderately. I mean, I enjoy wine with meals and this sort of business, but I don't roam around the streets.
What would you say to people? What would you say to people when they're talking about politics today? And there's a lot of scandals in relation to expenses. It has hit your own Senate there lately. We're reading about it, about what has been happening. What would you say to people in relation to politics and politicians, and in relation to scandals like that?
I think that's very regrettable. I think it's good that it's out in the open, and I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed of people who claim such vast amounts of money, apparently unjustifiably. That seems to be rubbing the nose of ordinary people right in the dirt, because there are people all over the country, as we speak, who are losing their jobs, who are watching their children being forced to emigrate once again, who are in difficulties paying their mortgages. And to see these kind of obscene amounts of money being gobbled up by politicians, I think it really upsets people. Sometimes the emphasis by the press is unfair, but there is sufficient substance there for it to justify real anger and outrage. And that's why I think it's great that there are young people who are interested in politics. I had a letter from a young fellow today who says he wants to go into politics, and what advice can I give him? And I was absolutely delighted, because we need people like that in it. And if I look at the position for young people as compared to my day, there were bad, backward-looking things in my day, but there were also great security. I mean, the church had respect. Politics had respect. The law had respect. And the banks were a byword for security. Now it's all gone. Those are the four pillars of society. There isn't one of them left undamaged. So whereas people in my generation had the gift of an automatic feeling of security and stability and respect for the institutions, there's not very much reason to respect any of those institutions. They've all disgraced themselves.
How does David Norris relax after a day's work in Leinster House? And what about his taste in music?
Well, I love music. And as I was saying to you during the interval, I had a marvellous piano teacher, the late Lily Huben. Her people were from Gort in County Galway. But Lily was the demonstration pupil for the great pianist Alfred Cortot in Paris in the 1920s. Cortot was a pupil of Leschetizky, who was a pupil of Chopin himself. So when I was studying the Nocturnes with Lily Huben in a little garret in Harcourt Street in Dublin, just off St. Stephen's Green, I was being taught by a pupil of a pupil of a pupil of Chopin. Isn't that a wonderful thing? And the other thing is, I have very Catholic taste in music. I love the music of the Orthodox Church, the Russian Orthodox Church, these wonderful unaccompanied male voice choirs with their very deep basses in the most lovely harmony. And then, of course, jazz. My oldest friend, Michael Morn, his father was a well-known businessman and had been educated in England. And in 1919, the original Dixieland jazz band from New Orleans, Louisiana, came over to London via New York and set the place ablaze. Mr. Morn had a collection of the original Dixieland jazz band records, and they wrote and recorded things like Tiger Rag. You know, that wonderful growl from the trombones. Hold that tiger, hold that tiger. Well, I have all the records. Of course, they're all dead now. But the son of the leader and cornet player, Nick LaRocca, and his name nowadays is Jimmy LaRocca, Jimmy, the son, reformed the original Dixieland Jazz Band with musicians from New Orleans, Louisiana, and for my 60th birthday, I flew them from New Orleans to play at my birthday party in the James Joyce Center in North Great Georgia Street, and that should have cost me $60,000.
What would the epitaph?
It cost me nothing because I sold them on for European tour. I haven't got that kind of money and I wouldn't waste it. And Harry Crosby gave me Vicar Street as a present. He said, put them on there, that'll pay for your party. I said, no, it won't. We'll put them on the Friday. I will do it for cancer and the DePaul Trust, the homeless. And then we'll feel we've done our good deed and we can enjoy ourselves without any pangs of conscience on the Saturday. What would my epitaph be?
Yeah, how would you like Davis Norris to be remembered?
I'd like to be remembered gently and with affection. And I have chosen my grave, and I've actually seen it, because they put a stone on it with my name on it. I didn't know they were going to do that. It was down in Leash in a tiny little place called Roskelton, where my great-grandfather and his father are buried. And I'll be in a row with all these McGillipatricks, McGillipatricks, Fitzpatricks. And the epitaph I'd like a plain tombstone and on it the words from Shakespeare. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep.
What better way to finish? David Norris, you're one of these people that I find after meeting, you walk away feeling much, much better and with a lighter step. Thank you for joining me in conversation, and wherever life brings you and whatever happens, all I say to you is the best of luck.
Thank you very much, Rishi, and my love to Kerry and all his people.